chronic pain is a common problem, actually. Pain that continues mysteriously long after the original injury. Dr. Rachel Zofnis is the author of The Pain Management Workbook. She is an assistant clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and a lecturer at Stanford University. And she says that there is no evidence that the current treatment addresses the social and psychological factors that amplify the experience of pain. I asked her why she thought chronic pain seemed to be increasing.
I think there's a lot of reasons that chronic pain is on the rise. I think one of the main reasons that's happening is because the way we treat pain is miserably, woefully broken. For many decades, we've framed pain as a purely biomedical or biological problem, something to do just with tissue damage or system dysfunction. But what we now know about pain is that it's never a purely biological thing to do with tissue damage. It's rather a biopsychosocial thing, which is a big and sometimes confusing word. But all that means is that the experience we call pain, of course, has to do with our tissues and our biology, but it also has to do with other influences as well, including how we're feeling emotionally, like our stress and our anxiety and our mood, whether we're depressed or happy, and what's happening in our social lives and our greater environment. All the stressors in our greater environment can amplify pain too. So what we saw, for example, during the COVID pandemic was an explosion of chronic pain, which is not surprising when we think about the greater context of pain or the things that trigger and amplify pain, because we know that major life stressors, including a pandemic, will amplify pain volume, and things like social isolation will also amplify pain volume. So if we're seeing an epidemic in stress and anxiety around the globe, and we surely are, we can expect a co-occurring explosion in chronic pain. So that's one of the reasons I think we're seeing an increase.
Of course, that is a vicious cycle, isn't it? Because the more stress you feel, the more pain you might experience. The more pain you experience, the more socially isolated you might become.
That's exactly right. And there's a well-established and well-known stress-pain cycle, which is chronic pain is actually one of the most significant stressors on a human. So if you think about things that are very stressful for us, you know, moving across the country is a stressor, and death of a loved one is a significant stressor, but living with pain day in and day out is also a major stressor. So you're right. One of the well-established cycles that we know in chronic pain is that having pain is a significant stressor, and having that stress actually changes our brain and body, resulting in pain amplification. So stress goes up, pain goes up, muscles get more tight, pain system response amplifies. And as pain goes up, stress goes up. As stress goes up, pain goes up. So as you mentioned, it becomes this vicious cycle of pain amplification and stress amplification.
So when you say changing your brain can change your pain, I suspect you're not saying something as simple as mind over matter, are you?
Totally not. I actually really reject the phrase mind over matter when it comes to pain, because I find it to be extremely dismissive, and it suggests in this way that I find irritating that pain is all psychological, or you can think your way out of pain, and you can't. That's not how that works. What research shows is that because pain is a biopsychosocial phenomenon, there are a lot of cognitive and emotional and biological and environmental factors that are always both amplifying pain and also reducing pain. But more to your question, when I say that changing the brain can change pain, the reason I say that is because what science shows is that while it's easy to believe that pain lives exclusively in the body part that hurts, like in your bad back or your aching knee, It's not actually true that pain lives exclusively in the body. And rather, what science reveals is that pain is constructed by the brain. And one of the reasons we know this is because of a condition called phantom limb pain. And phantom limb pain is when someone loses a limb, an arm or a leg, and they continue to have terrible pain in the missing body part. And if you can have terrible leg pain in a leg that's no longer attached to your body, that tells us pretty definitively that pain must be constructed somewhere else. It's not just your leg. And we know now, because of modern pain neuroscience that's been evolving, since the gait control theory of pain in 1965, that pain is constructed ultimately by our central nervous system, our brain, and our spinal cord. And many things are constantly adjusting the pain experience. What we now know, and this is a great thing for both people living with pain and also people who treat pain, is that if you can change the brain, you can change pain. And it is not, as you mentioned, as simple as just mind over matter or thinking your way out of pain. So I'm really glad you brought that up, and I want to make sure that no one thinks we're saying that.
If pain is the body's warning system, telling us not to do something or telling us not to do something again, and the cause of the pain goes, why does it persist?
Pain is constructed not by the body part that hurts, but actually by your brain. So what that means is that, you can have chronic back pain in the absence of damage to your back. And I know that that's a wild thought for a lot of people, but what neuroscience reveals is that one of the processes by which pain becomes chronic is a process called central sensitization. And I'm going to say what that is. The pathways in your brain are like the muscles in your body. The more you use them, the bigger and stronger they get over time. So if you said to me, I want really big biceps, I would say, that's great, Kim Hill. Go to the gym and lift lots of weights. And over time, your bicep muscles in your arms will get really big and strong. We all know that's true. It turns out the pathways in your brain are much the same. The more we practice a particular thing, the more we use the pathways in our brain dedicated to that particular skill. So for me, that was piano. And when I was a little girl, my mom would make me practice the piano. And over time, after a while, after practicing many, many, many times, my fingers just knew what to do when I sat down at the piano. And the reason for that is because this pathway, as I'm going to call it, in my brain got bigger and stronger over time with practice and experience. And what science has shown is that, unfortunately, that's not just true of piano, it's true of all the things that humans practice or do over and over with time. So we know that the longer we have pain, unfortunately, the bigger and stronger the pain pathways in our central nervous system become. And I want to be clear to say there is no one single pain pathway. It's different from person to person, but we know that with experience and time, chronic pain, that pain pathway in your brain gets bigger and stronger. And when that happens, we say that our brain has become sensitive to pain. And what that means is that smaller and smaller bits of sensory input from the body are misinterpreted by the brain as dangerous. And because pain is our body's warning system, our danger detection system, the brain will then amplify sensory messages from the body and give us these danger messages or these pain messages, even in the absence of actual damage to the body. And we know this is one of the major processes that underlies chronic pain, whether it's chronic knee pain or chronic back pain. And again, it's easy to believe that that pain lives just in your back or just in your knee. And so, as you said before, if, for example, the injury in your knee is better and has been better for 4 years, and you still have chronic knee pain, it's pretty clear that that pain isn't due to this particular damage to your knee because that damage is gone. It's no longer. And what we now know is that chronic pain persists because of changes to the brain and the central nervous system.
So the corollary of that, I suppose this is self-evident, is that the longer one suffers from chronic pain, the harder it is to treat because it's become, you use the word sensitization. I'm not sure whether it's the same thing to say, the more ingrained it is in the brain.
I think that is fair to say, and I want to say that there's a caveat to that. One of the most important messages I'm trying to always give to people living with pain is that there is hope for treating chronic pain. Chronic pain is treatable. All kinds of chronic pain. It doesn't matter whether it's fibromyalgia or post-surgical pain, or as we mentioned, some sort of chronic back pain condition, which is so ubiquitous and so common. And the reason it's so hopeful to me to explain that pain is constructed ultimately by the brain is that the brain is constantly changing. The pain system is neuroplastic. Just as our pain system and our brain can become more and more sensitive with time, it can also become less sensitive with time. So what happens with chronic pain a lot of the time, and I say this as someone who has lived with chronic pain, is that we become understandably very afraid of moving and doing things and engaging in life and activity. Of course, that makes perfect sense because pain is our body's danger detection system. And we reasonably believe that those pain messages are telling us to stop doing things, stop exercising, stay home, stay in bed, stay inside. And with chronic pain, you know, what we know is a lot of this is false messaging, false advertising from the brain telling you, stop doing everything because you're in grave danger. And we know that that's not actually true largely when it comes to chronic pain. And so one of the treatments for chronic pain that is most critical is learning how to desensitize your sensitive brain and find safe ways to re-engage in your life physically and socially and emotionally, and expose your brain to small bits of sensory input so that it can desensitize over time. And there's many ways of doing this. And I wrote the pain management workbook in part because I wanted everybody to have access to this information, because pain science, in my very humble and strong opinion, should not belong exclusively to scientists. In my opinion, pain science belongs to everybody, because all of us have pain, and not a single one of us is going to escape in our lifetimes from pain. It's coming for everybody. So in the pain management workbook, there is in there what's called a pacing plan, and it explains how you can gradually desensitize your brain so that chronic pain has less of a hold over your life and over your activity and over your social engagement, so that you can decrease pain volume and get back to your life. But changing pain is always possible. And I don't want people to think that just because we're talking about how your pain system becomes more sensitive over time, that that's a life sentence. There's no such thing as a life sentence of chronic pain.
I'm talking to Dr. Rachel Zofnes. She's the author of the Pain Management Workbook. So your chronic pain, can you tell me about that?
I actually tend to not talk about it that much, but the general gist of it is I was a kid with chronic pain and didn't understand it. And I went to a lot of doctors and I was prescribed a lot of medications and there were a lot of procedures. And I really wish that I had known then what I know now about pain. It wasn't until I went off to college and went down this rabbit hole of, I was a neuroscience major, brain and behavior is what I studied. And I had a professor at Brown University, his name was Mark Baer, and he explained to us that pain was this phenomenon that lived at the intersection of neuroscience and biology and medicine, and also psychology and emotions and mental health. And I was trying to understand how this phenomenon that had been explained to me my whole life as something that was purely physical and purely biological was so much more complex than that. So I ended up doing my honors thesis on the gait control theory of pain, and I've been studying pain ever since. And you know, I'm largely better now. And I try and disseminate this information to my patients, and I have this great luxury of watching as a lot of my patients with chronic pain, and some of them are teenagers and children, get out of bed and go back to life and get asked to prom and go off to college. And it's just the most amazing, miraculous work.
So not to personalize it too much, do you have to keep doing whatever you did to alleviate your chronic pain forever? Or once cured, is that it?
Great question. I've never been asked that before. I think my honest answer is that it's probably different for different people. It turns out that if you want to keep pain volume low, what you really need to do is live a healthy life. You need to have good sleep hygiene, and you need to have good nutrition, and you have to move your body and exercise, and you have to get nature and sunlight, and you have to regulate your stress and anxiety, and you have to find ways to be connected socially and not be too isolated. So the true treatment of chronic pain is targeting the whole person, not just a body part, not just your brain, and not just your knee, and not just your back. That's the real treatment of chronic pain. So, I mean, if I'm being honest, answering your question, in order for me to have a low pain volume, I actually just need to be a healthy human being. And I think we all strive for that anyway, because pain is sort of this message that your body is out of balance, something is wrong, you know? I sort of strive to make sure that I'm okay across the board, whether or not I'm having a day with some pain or not. And I think it really is different for different people because I have a number of patients who don't have any pain and haven't had pain for many years. And I'm pretty sure they've fallen off the wagon with at least some of our pain management protocol. But I do think it varies.
Essentially, you're arguing against what has become the over-medicalization of pain, are you?
Yes, I think what I'm arguing against is pro-science and anti-ignorance, because we've been living in this biomedical model for since Descartes. And by biomedical, I simply mean we have framed pain and a lot of other human health conditions as things that are just to do with anatomy and physiology, but science has evolved well beyond that, thank God, over the past decades. And we know now that we're more than just a knee. You know, we're more than just a body part. Humans are extremely complex. For example, we know now that trauma doesn't just live in your body, it also lives in your brain, and it's affected by your emotional health. And we know that trauma is a huge predictor of chronic pain. In fact, they're comorbid, or they co-occur up to 80% of the time. And if we're really trying to treat chronic pain, we cannot focus just on back surgeries alone or just prescribed medications. That's ignorant. And we need to treat trauma, and we need to look at mental health and refer people to psychologists. And we need to integrate things like occupational therapy and physical therapy. A pill alone is not going to do the job when it comes to chronic pain. Now, I want to be clear. I am not saying that medication doesn't have a place in pain medicine. It absolutely does. And, you know, thank the mighty science gods for pain medications for post-surgical pain, you know, for acute conditions that are short-term when you don't have a complicated history of addiction. You know, I think medications, of course, have a place, and procedures, of course, have a place. They save lives. I'm not anti-surgery. But what I am against is this very narrow, restricted focus on the biomedical model, which is so outdated, but for some reason, to do with money. Pharma has really taken control of the narrative and has convinced us all that, you know, a pill is really the solution for pain when, you know, we know over many decades of research that it's just not enough on its own.
Pharma had a willing audience, though. I mean, people are more inclined to say, you know, just give me the pill.
Oh, all of us fall prey to that. Who doesn't want a quick fix for anything that hurts, you know, whether it's physical or emotional? And the interesting thing about pain is that it's always physical and emotional 100% of the time. And one of the reasons we know, by the way, that opioids are so effective for pain is that they mask not just the physical aspects of pain, but they also mask the pain of sadness and the stress of living with pain day in and day out, and the anxiety and the agony of social isolation. So, yes, of course, it makes perfect sense that we're willing recipients of the, you know, take two of these and call me in the morning model. But I think what I'm hoping to promote is that, you know, I think at the end of the day, what we all want is for pain to actually be treated, you know, not just to have a band-aid. And the actual treatment for pain, which is fortunate and unfortunate, is not a quick fix. It is more complicated than we thought it was, but that's not bad news. It just means that humans are more complicated than, you know, a torn ligament or a slipped disc. We're more than that. And that's good news. It's not bad news. And we do know that we can change the brain to change pain. So hopefully at the end of the day, even though the message is, yes, it's going to take a little longer than popping two pills, which turns out we know with the opioid epidemic is not actually a perfect treatment, it gives us a lot of hope and it gives us some marching orders and it gives us a roadmap for the way forward.
Are people referred to you or do they come of their own accord? In other words, are you part of the medical system?
I want to say loudly and clearly that nobody wants to see a psychologist for pain. Nobody, because, no. You know, we've nobody.
That was my next question. You know.
Yeah, of course, because, you know, the thought is there's a lot of stigma around psychology for everything, but especially for pain, because we've been sold this lie that pain is a purely biological biomedical problem that requires a purely biological biomedical solution. And by that, I mean pills and procedures. So if anything else is suggested, it absolutely and understandably triggers this response like, oh, are you saying it's all in my head? Are you saying it's just emotional or it's just psychological or I'm mentally ill? And one of my big goals in life is to remove that stigma, which, by the way, it turns out is incredibly hard to do. But that's sort of why I like talking about the neuroscience of pain, because if we can relocate pain construction from the knee alone or the back alone to the brain and body working in concert, what's really critically cool and important about that is that it's not just one part of the brain that makes pain. You know, your brain's limbic structures, your emotion centers, which are all over your brain, are part of what creates the pain experience. So emotional health and physical health are connected 100% of the time. In Western medicine, we have this divide. Either your pain is physical and you see a physician, a medical doctor, or your pain is emotional and you should see a therapist or a psychologist. But neuroscience reveals that's never how pain works, ever. It's always physical and emotional, always both. So if we're not treating both, we're not treating pain.
You tell the story of the two nails, right? And one is a construction worker and he saw this nail go straight through his foot and he was in terrible pain and he went to hospital and it turned out that the nail had passed through the space between his toes and there was no wound.
That's
right.
There
was no tissue damage.
That's
right. But he felt this terrible pain.
That's
right. Which indicates that pain can be purely in the mind without any biological input.
In that moment, this particular construction worker was on a job site and he jumped off a plank, as you said, straight onto this 7-inch nail that went through his boot. And it's your brain's job to save your life and keep you safe. That is your brain's job. So his brain used all available information to determine whether or not he was safe, and if he was not safe, how much pain needed to be constructed or made in order to protect him. So his brain used all available information that, you know, was accessible in that moment, including knowledge of past pain experiences on the job site and knowledge of how dangerous it is to be a construction worker. It used this visual input that it had of this 7-inch nail protruding through the top of his boot. It used the horror on his coworkers' faces as they looked down at his shoe. It used, you know, the emotions he was feeling in the moment, panic and stress. And because his brain perceived potential damage and danger to his body, it made pain to protect him. But if you think about it, that is, of course, a biological process. Your brain is gathering information from all of your sensory receptors all over your body and collecting that data and then interpreting it, because your brain is a prediction machine. And because his brain believed he was in danger, it constructed pain. So, you know, that happens all the time. There's many examples of this happening where pain is amplified or reduced by contextual and emotional information. It happens to all of us every day. If you think about it, for example, if you stub your toe on the day you get fired from work, that very same injury is going to hurt significantly more than that exact same toe stubbing incident if you're on the beach with friends on a Sunday hanging out. So injuries always feel different depending on context and your emotional state and all of the information your brain is gathering in any given moment.
So that construction worker, once it was revealed to him that his foot was completely uninjured, did his perception of pain, did his pain all go away?
You know, I have wished many times that I could interview this particular construction worker, but the article,
Yes.
but the article that comes from is long gone. It's not a very in-depth article, and it didn't reveal the name of the person. But
Well,
what I
sure
can
that it's
tell.
not apocryphal, right? It's not an
No.
apocryphal story.
No, it's not. And
Okay.
you know, here I'll tell you a related and interesting story. I was seeing a patient who had chronic kidney stones, chronic pain due to kidney stones. And kidney stones are thought to be among the most painful experiences humans can have. And that's not true for everybody. I have met patients with kidney stones who pass them without significant incident. But this particular patient said to me, "You know, there's a pattern to my kidney stones, and I know what it feels like when I'm first starting to get one. I have this sensation in my abdomen." And she says, "And I know when I'm about to pass it." And she says, "And then the pain lasts typically, I think for her, it was about 4 days. And on a scale of 0 to 10, her pain would reach about a 6, typically." And she said, "There was this one instance where, you know, it was lasting longer than normal, this abdominal pain, you know, and the pain was about a 6, but instead of lasting just a few days, it was lasting a week and then a little more than a week." And she said, "You know, my husband said to me, 'Oh, what if this isn't a kidney stone? What if you have some sort of cancer?'" And she said this to me in session. She said, "As soon as he said that, I started thinking, 'Oh my God, this might be something else. It's lasting longer than normal.'" And she said, "The pain shot up to an 11 out of 10. She fell to the floor. She grabbed her abdomen. She was writhing in pain. She couldn't even stand. And her husband rushed her to the emergency room, and the doctors did a scan of her abdomen to see if they could figure out what was going on and if they could find a tumor or whatever was the cause of this 11 out of 10 pain that she'd never experienced before. And the doctors found on the scan, and she could see it in front of her face, a kidney stone. And she said, "As soon as I saw the stone on the screen, my pain went back down. It went down to a 2 out of 10, and I was able to go home." Now, I want to be clear that this is not true of everybody. Not everybody has experiences like this. And I am not trying to suggest that pain is all in your head. Pain is never, ever all in your head, as hopefully revealed by these stories. It's always a construction and a dance between your brain and body working together in concert, always. But in her particular case, these thoughts of danger and the messages of danger from her husband, "Oh, this might be cancer," amplified her pain volume so much that she was rendered incapacitated. And as soon as the doctor found the actual cause of her pain, and it was familiar and she knew what it was, her pain or the danger messages went back down. So it is a complicated dance, and it is always influenced by cognitive and emotional factors in addition to biological and somatic and bodily factors.